Hello and welcome to The Money Cafe. I'm Evan Lucas, Head of Strategy at InvestSmart, and joining me today, and I'm really excited by this guest to be on today, is Ben Kingsley, co-host of the Property Couch podcast, Chair of the Property Investor Council of Australia, and Managing Director of Empower Wealth Advisory. Sorry, mate, I've got to get that right. Ben, welcome to The Money Cafe. Very, very excited to have you on.
Oh, and I'm thrilled to be on, Evan, so let's get into it. I can't wait.
Yeah, it's a ripping time. I'm going to throw you right in the deep end because there is a lot of talk in your world, particularly housing at the moment, about affordability. And I know you talk about investment in property, but I do want to get your opinion at the moment is that there is a lot of talk around affordability and there's a lot of talk about how much influence the RBA is having on that. Can I get your opinion on those topics?
Yeah, we'll start with the big ones early. So, look, affordability comes in a couple of forms. The first one is it true affordability or have I got an expectation that I'd like to be able to live in a location which is unaffordable to me? So, for those people who sort of are the latter, I realise that that's mentally a challenge for them. But in terms of affordability, it's a simple equation. It's effectively what you can afford to borrow that you can comfortably afford over time. So, we refer to this as part of what we call the buyer's decision quadrant, which is the decisions that one makes to have that informed view around where they want to buy. Now, whether that's an investor or whether that's someone buying to live in that property, the same principles apply, right? In other words, what's my budget in terms of what lifestyle features and facilities and infrastructure do I want? How much sort of land am I going to get as part of that story? Because land's a big thing when it comes to property in Australia. And then finally, you know, what is the type of property that I'm going to be able to pay for? So, you know, and usually when people are making buyer's decision, one of those four quadrants has to give. So whether it is, you know, I really want to live in X suburb, but all I can afford is a townhouse as opposed to a freestanding property on a larger block of dirt. That is the conversation that most people need to be having. And as investors, if I put my investor hat on, really the smart investor is a price taker, not so much a price maker. So when effectively 70% of the stock is owned by owner occupiers, they buy with their hearts, not necessarily just purely based on the financials. And so a smart investor should be studying their behaviors and getting in behind in those locations that they're looking at, as opposed to, you know, when a pure investor is, say, speculating on a mining town, the mix is different. You know, you've got 30% owner-occupier and 70% investor, and that's why those markets are also quite volatile compared to the general markets of the major capital cities and the established regional areas.
Going to pick up on your word that I absolutely love, which is behavior, and that smart investor using that behavior. We were discussing just quickly offline, and I want to come to that point around breaking those mental barriers of getting into the market. You talked about there about getting a freestanding versus a townhouse piece of property. Is it also around breaking those mental barriers over, you know, basically local government areas? Do you find that also one of the bigger mistakes is that they are concentrating on areas they want to live in now rather than going through the journey and breaking that down, going into other areas, getting the return, and then coming back to that area they want in the future?
I think, you know, in a lot of cases, it's absolutely critical that they'll have a trade-off. And as part of that trade-off, they've got to make that understanding of what happens from a gentrification point of view in certain locations. So good examples are obviously our established cities, which have been relatively well planned. And normally you'll have what we call an upper market, higher quartile, more expensive land, more expensive dwellings. And then there'll be a ripple effect around that. And also when we start to study, you know, the 100 odd years of property and the development of those communities, is we also had working areas. Those working areas in Sydney consisted of, you know, Redfern, Alexandria, Erskineville, and those type of working cottages next to the rail yards. In Melbourne, we saw it in examples of Collingwood, Fitzroy, and then also the inner west, which we saw Kensington, Flemington, and those types of things, as opposed to the leafy east. And we see the same thing occurring in Adelaide, where we also have the really high end and the prestigious side of town. And then you have, you know, the sort of that lower end side of town. So that is relatively consistent, but the smart money does move in terms of finding those areas of gentrification and seeing past what's there now to what could be there. And we do see that in terms of the cafe lifestyle, the trend that's going on in the area, and then basically that younger generation that moves in and gentrifies that area and makes that investment, which obviously uplifts and ultimately finishes up in the land value.
Going back to the first question, and I want to get back to you because I really want to understand your point of view here, is the RBA, how much is it playing into what is clearly a very, very hot property market, and what do you see as possible levers to be pulled to inverted commas, slow it down? Now, I know that's not great because it probably won't slow down, but what do you see as regulation or other macro levers that could be pulled to try and get this affordability issue that people are pointing to back into check?
I took a great interest in Governor Lowe's speech from earlier this week around his views on this. And I think he made it really clear in regards to the fact that, yes, we all understand you make money cheaper, that the human side of property, the emotional side of property, is that people normally fill their bucket in terms of what they can borrow, and they spend to that upper limit. And we do know that obviously causes an asset appreciation as part of that story. I continue on that point that the greater good that he's trying to serve around prosperity, creating the jobs and hitting their mandates of inflation and full employment, he's got a bigger cause here that he has to go after, and he knows that the byproduct of that is definitely going to be higher prices. But he's sort of advocating that's not his job. His job is to look at that, and I concur with him 100% that in terms of the planning regulations, the tax legislation, those types of things are the macro areas that we need to look at to effectively bring greater supply into play and obviously have what I would call a sustainable property market, and not this sort of media hype that we have around boom and bust. It's not the equity markets. A lot of people, it's an essential need and it's of shelter, and we need to understand that. And as investors, we also need to make sure that we don't get ahead of ourselves as well when we're coming into this market in terms of taking a mid-term to longer-term view, because we do know, yes, cheap money has definitely caused a real spike in demand as there's been many, many areas of the community that haven't really been impacted in terms of jobs and incomes, and they are creating a significant wealth base during this period, as opposed to some of our more unfortunate members of the community in hospitality, tourism, retail. Those types of areas have really been challenged, and that's unfortunate for them. But I concur with the Governor Lowe that ultimately he's doing the right thing for the broader good of the economy. But like all things, this property boom will slow down, and that which comes to your second part of your question: how do you manipulate that market when it's going so strong? APRA is going to have to do some signalling to the market, and I'm hoping that signalling, along with the fact that we shouldn't have, our short term memory should remind us of 2017 and 2018, when they actually also did potentially introduce some of those macroprudential changes, that in itself should change, hopefully, some of the perception out there around is now the right time to go. Because I've been doing property now for 25 years, and my advice to anyone who's going to invest in property is you invest in property when you can afford to, sensibly, and you have a long-term view. You don't come in because there's a quick buck to be made in property. I think that's the wrong approach to most investing, in my view. So I'd like to think that is going to be the short-term lever. When middle of next year, maybe after the election, depending on who wins the federal election, we might start to see that. Because what's also showing up is, in terms of mortgage arrears and delinquencies and sensible lending, it's actually still holding up, Evan.
Yeah, it is. And that was the question that I was going to go from there, is that there was suggestions that maybe they'll look at debt-to-income ratio. There was suggestions that they were going to look at capping the amount of properties that you can hold. I agree with you. I don't see those standing up. But again, it could change with the election next year, because there is certainly a want in the Labor Party to change property laws, and that makes sense. I don't understand that completely. But that will be something to watch into the future. Right, let's look out to where we are. We're moving into spring, and spring is a period that you and I know very well is an interesting and exciting time of the year for the property market. Do you see 2021 being slightly different? Is it different this time around because of COVID, or are we going to get that spring uptick that we always get?
It's extraordinarily different because, I mean, in Victoria, well, in Melbourne, you virtually can't inspect a property. So What is fascinating still, though, is people are buying properties based on video walkthroughs. And spending in the millions in some examples where they've literally haven't been able to inspect the property. So extraordinary insight into still the level of that underpinning demand that we're seeing. We're seeing the search engine portals, the real estate portals also indicating some really strong, sort of online search interest, which we monitor very closely. The auction clearance rate numbers, well, they're just so difficult to read. But you're seeing Sydney sort of still eking out really, really strong results in very, very difficult circumstances. So there is no doubt there's pent-up demand. We know it from speaking with the agents that we buy the properties off, that they've got more properties to come online. We also know that if the price is right, there's a lot of off-market and pre-market sales that are going on for those, super active in the marketplace. And that's, so it is a sort of a season like no other. Now, we can obviously look at Melbourne's lockdown, the 102-day, 105-day lockdown we had sort of in that October, November, and that very much dented the opportunity for Melbourne's property prices to grow. And that's why we think that Melbourne is lagging in regards to, coming close to that 20% gain in the last 12 months. We think Melbourne's got a bit more to do once it reopens, but it just goes to show you that there is a lot of demand in the property market at the moment.
That brings to the next part of the question is, you talked about Melbourne lagging behind in that sort of movement. Where are you seeing the sort of the inverted commas, the value at the moment? It is a hot market and we know that. It has run very, very hard over the last 18 months. But where are you seeing value? Where is that in your mind?
Well, I think it still comes into the price ranges. So we see the most challenge in terms of competition in that affordable price range of that sort of, depending on the city. So you might say 500 to 600 in certain cities around Australia is very competitive in that middle tier or sort of more established outer ring areas, moving away from the sort of green field areas and the new subdivisions. Mm-hmm. We've definitely seen those subdivisions do very, very well under the government schemes, and we think that bodes well for stronger, sort of consumption and also productivity in the building and construction industry for the next 12 to 18 months. So we really feel like there's a nice pipeline there. The caveat on that is probably the medium and high density stuff. That's definitely coming off in terms of approvals. So you're going to see that we're already seeing the signs of building approvals and all of that slowing. So that also in itself will probably mean that unit markets will be undersupplied in the next couple of years. The big question mark on the unit market is really around the behavioural change that has potentially occurred. If you had have asked me this 12 months ago and we were coming out to zero transmission and we were thinking that we had COVID behind us before the Delta strain came in, I would have said that's not enough to necessarily taper people's desires to live in apartments. This time around, with further lockdowns and further uncertainty around COVID, there is still a little bit of a question mark on the future demand for that type of accommodation until the immigration arrives and we see that overseas migration start to rebound. And I suspect you'll see in probably 2 to 3 years, 4 years' time, that the apartment market will rebound and that price disparity, subject to keeping our health matters under control. And then coming back to your broader question, in that sort of 700 to 1 million range, There's a lot of competition in that space as well. In certainly Southeast Queensland, we are seeing Southeast Queensland performing very well. Adelaide's a great performer based on historical. It's normally a steady as she goes market, but no, that market's really popped in sort of the last sort of 6 to 8 months for us. We're now seeing a ripple effect occurring in Perth, where those markets in that sort of entry level affordability, where you are getting land, but also in established areas, that's going to start to show some interesting signs of growth, because what already occurred in the Perth market is the sort of upper end of the market has been very strong for over 12 months now. So we do expect that to move down through the price ranges into that sort of 500, 600, 700 very strong, and also at the bottom end of the market, that sort of 300,000 to 400,000, 450,000 to 500,000 market, we're going to see some interest, I think, from investors in that market as well, because there's a fair bit of yield to grab here, and obviously Perth is opened in terms of a trading economy. So from that point of view, we've seen a lot of population growth over here, and so their vacancy rates, which is their big challenge after, you know, sort of the exit of 2014, that's all been absorbed now. So that's basically, you know, a quick round of the grounds.
You talk about yield there before. I know that you and Bryce, when you do your talks, you talk very much about, you know, several different things in your strategy. But is yield one of the bigger things, or is it more about chasing the growth, which is, you know, clearly, in my world, being an investor, I do both. So I'll put my hand up and say that I'm a property investor and also an investor in equity markets. But what metric do you still see as one of the better ways to gauge a property to get into it, an asset that you believe should be absolutely picked up?
Yeah, look, I mean, in a perfect world, you know, growth is the bee's knees. I mean, the compounding interest return on a property of 8% and beyond over a 30 or 40 year period is life changing just on one investment property. Hmm. So if you can get that long term sustainable growth, you're doing very, very well. Now, we've got to remember that you know, the property market and that compounding return has held up remarkably well, but that's really been on the back of a couple of really transitional things that we've seen in our economy: double household incomes, and then obviously this incredible reduction in interest rates paid, and which has led to obviously greater borrowing power, and the asset values have landed where that affordability or that borrowing power lives. So if you're asking me what's the next generation of people going to be able to look at, I think they definitely need a blend. And, you know, we know one of the biggest challenges for most households is saving that deposit, getting in on the property ladder. And so we've got to be mindful of those people and train them up as the next generation of owner-occupiers and investors around potentially getting in on an entry-level property, potentially doing some cosmetic renovations to bring it up to a suitable asset where you will be able to increase the rental yield. And that rental yield will keep you in the game whilst interest rates remain where they are. So your out-of-pocket expenses and that big, heavily negative geared property, when you are starting to push into sort of 1.5 to 2 million to buy in those sort of what we refer to as the blue chip locations, that becomes harder and harder. So I think the middle tier and sort of more established and affordable markets are probably going to have a reasonable time of it, subject to the economic activity within that city. So if they're, you know, if they've got nice, diverse economic activity and got nice, diverse infrastructure, those locations will bode well. And with, again, the cost of money being so low, yield is definitely going to be a real consideration for those people as they start their property investment journey or getting on the property ladder to start out.
Let's also now talk about, let's say the investor has gone through that process, they're in, they've got your 3, 4, or 5 investment properties. Something you also are very passionate about and talk very well about is what you refer to as debt retirement as part of the strategy. What do you see as one of the better ways of doing it? Is it, you know, slimming down your portfolio to 3 from 5, using that profit to actually, you know, retire the debt? What do you do, or what do you see as one of the best ways of debt retirement?
Yeah, it's a really important question, and I welcome it, because one of the things we need to understand is that when our loan-to-value ratio hits a certain level, and you know, with higher interest rates, that level used to be around 65% loan-to-value ratio. You would pretty much be neutrally geared around that point, subject to what depreciation ability you had in the property. But a nice rule of thumb now is that if you're starting to build and or you've built out that portfolio, you should be quite cash flow positive as your loan-to-value ratios move down. So we believe in basically having a fairly liquid position by putting that money into an offset account and building up those offset buckets and then giving yourself a choice into the future. So when you are sort of strategizing and planning out for a passive income of, you know, let's call hypothetically $2,000 per week, you're normally acquiring 3 to 4 good properties. With good planning and cash flow forecasting, you shouldn't have to sell any of those properties depending on how early you start. So we would, our first principle is not sell, and then let's forecast basically how quickly we can get that passive income to us to a level that's not only paying debt down but also supplementing our retirement income. But in the event that that situation doesn't exist or we want to have access to greater income when we're sort of more agile and able in our early retirements where we want to spend more, then the consideration then comes back to looking at each of the properties in isolation and seeing effectively what returns they're giving us and how well they've performed over the lifetime of holding that asset, considering what maintenance and upkeep we might need to perform on that asset to see whether we would cash out of one of those and take that supplementary cash flow to bank into the offset, which basically just buys us more time. And so what we do see for those people who are rushing or not considering all of those elements and doing that proper cash flow modeling is that they might sell 2 properties straight away. Now, there's capital gains consequences associated with that. So those types of timing considerations need to be put into play. And then ultimately, you know, what is the net proceeds that we're going to get from that in terms of how much time that buys us? Because we're also, even though, yes, we're biased towards residential property, we also absolutely understand that super is going to play an important role. There's the requirement of a minimum spend in super that's also going to supplement our retirement income. So it really does come down to a tailored solution for each household, but that gives you some idea about the logical approach in which we take.
Mm-hmm. And it clearly shows very clearly that time heals everything, and time in the market, time in your property and paying down your property is the aim of the game for everything that we do. Ben, that's been a great talk. I think it's time to probably move on to questions, because I know there'll be a lot of listeners out there that'll be absolutely gunning for the questions. So we've got a few here. As always, guys, don't forget, if you do want to write in to us here at The Money Cafe, the email is themoneycafe@eurekareport.com.au, and I'll read that again at the end. But I do want to get into this, Ben, because these are your questions for sure. So the first one comes from Angus. And the question says, I'm sure you have now heard that the Olympics is coming to Brisbane in 2032. What would you say to the growing trend of investors looking at Queensland Capital as an investment property to cash in on the potential property rise? And then there's a second question. It says, and if you had the power to enact one piece of financial legislation, what would it be? So I'll go with the first part of Angus's question. I actually want to come in and talk to you about the second part myself.
Sure. Look, the first part... There's no doubt that the property spruikers and the industry is going to talk up the future success of Brisbane. Now, having lived in Sydney during the Olympics of 2000, I can definitely tell you that some of the infrastructure programs that were implemented during that time, you know, Eastern Distributor is a good example, those types of lasting infrastructure matter in terms of mobility and the like. In terms of believing that you know, showcasing the Brisbane to the world is some way going to miraculously increase property prices, I still put a question mark on. I mean, ultimately, the people who can buy property in Australia are Australian citizens or New Zealand citizens and anything through the Foreign Investment Review Board, and they can only buy new. So I think from that point of view, we've got to put it into perspective in terms of what is the demand. There's no doubt that you know, it, having lived through the Olympics, it's an amazing time, and Brisbane and Southeast Queensland will have an incredible time during that period. But I don't think anyone, any investor or anyone who's buying for a house should think that an Olympics is a means by which it'll guarantee us a stronger return than anywhere else. I think you've got to come back to the long-term principles and looking at the fundamentals in those markets to say whether it's going to be a good idea to be investing in Queensland. I mentioned earlier that Southeast Queensland is really, really busy. I can give you some examples. We were buying properties there, sort of this time last year in the late 400s. Well, we can't buy those properties right now until the mid sixes. So that sort of gives you some idea in terms of the movement that's gone into that particular market. So you will have those cycles, and that will ultimately, you know, peter out over the course of the next 12 or 18 months. But coming back to the story of, I really want to be looking at the infrastructure and looking at the scarcity and not necessarily get so overwhelmed by the fact that, Brisbane's going to be showcased to the world.
Second part of that question from Angus was the financial piece of legislation. Anything off, comes off your
head? Yeah, can I have two here? Can I have one for the mum and dad investor?
For the
mum and dad investor, I don't believe that we should have made the changes to depreciation and also to be able to claim travel costs. I get that there might have been excesses for borderless investors going to Queensland and spending, 2 weeks up there and trying to claim that as a deduction to inspect their investment property. I think there should be a cap on it. So I'd like to see a cap of, $1,000 for interstate travel to inspect a property and $500 a year, because you're talking about some of these assets are worth $500,000 or $1 million for some people. Yet if I was a company or the big end of town, I could claim that. But as a mum and dad investor, I can't claim that. So, reintroduce depreciation correctly and also those travel exemption costs correctly. And I'm going to be a little bit more controversial on my big macro one. GST's got to increase. We are a wealthy nation. There are people who are benefiting, and there's no better way than a consumption tax, in my view, mm-hmm. as one of the critical bits of tax infrastructure that needs to be addressed, and we just need the political will for it.
Yeah, that's the term, the political will, and you find me a politician at the moment that's got the political will to do that. I can wholeheartedly agree. I'm a little bit different. I'm actually going to throw something out there for you that I think will be an interesting discussion that hasn't been picked up yet, and you talked about super before, and for me, super is something that I think absolutely needs to be looked at legislation-wise. And what we've learned through the COVID period is that our health system, as we get older and older and older and we have that aging population, is going to get more and more expensive, and it's going to need proper funding. The reason I raise that is that I believe that once you hit your retirement age and you retire 65 or older, and that immediate tax comes through where you get zero taxation on your super going forward, I believe Medicare should go straight into super and kick in. And what I mean by that, I know this will make people a little bit sort of standoffish, Medicare should be on a scaling number on the earnings that your super has over retirement. So it could be 2% to earnings up to 20 grand per year, and so on and so forth, up to, in my view, if you're earning over 120 to even as much as some people are earning $200,000 a year tax-free in their super,
yep.
that it is funding Medicare at 10%.
And yeah.
That, to me, I think is a legislation that politicians could do. I know it's controversial, but I cannot see super being taxed-free for the rest of the current period. It's just not possible. And I think if they're going to actually be able to pass legislation, do something that actually would work, and that is to pass health funding inside it. So that's my answer to that question.
And I think politically it's probably palatable, right? Because
yeah.
one of the things we understand when it comes to the broader Australian community is that they don't take a very keen interest in super. Very few people understand the requirements, understand you move through accumulation phase and then you move into pension phase and, the capital gains tax legislation and also the, as you say, in zero tax in pension phase and a 4% pay down, scaling down. I think it's got some merit in terms of, it's a system that we need to keep standing up.
Yeah, it needs to keep improving.
Absolutely.
And that's what it is. And I think it only makes sense that the part of the population that is most likely to touch the healthcare system going forward, being those that are slightly older and therefore into their later years,
yep,
probably need to help fund that rather than putting on their kids and their grandkids to do it. So COVID has made that clear, that, and it was coming anyway. We knew the aging population problem was there. It was, there needs to be a better funding of the healthcare system, and Medicare is a fantastic system. It's not perfect, I get that, but yep, we still got to remember that in Australia, free healthcare is something that we take for granted. You look at the US and they would love to have that ability. Yeah. The political will isn't there, but we need to keep it working. And as you said, Ben, standing on its own two feet. And my view is that is one way politically that I think would be palatable to actually get that done. I think particularly a centre-left government would absolutely embrace that idea, because it would, you know, it plays to exactly their strength, which is health. And it could be something they could get through without having to then sort of, as the OECD said this week, we have a real big problem with personal income tax reliability in this country. Mm. It is too high.
It's too high.
And I completely concur with the GST. I think it should be at 15%. Again, people are going to get very upset with that. But it is a fairer tax system.
It is.
And I think these are the ways, the levers you can pull to actually do it. Great question, Angus. Thank you so much. I'll move on. We've got one from Dennis. With all the uncertainty and fluctuations in house prices, do you see an increased benefit of using a buyer's agent or even a professional auction bidder?
Oh, full disclosure here, I've got a conflict as a buyer's agent and as an owner of a buyer's agency business. Of course, I'm going to be a little... Look, I'll say there's no doubt if someone practices their craft on a regular basis, you would like to think that they are very, very attuned to the craft of what they needed to do. Now, if you didn't practice your craft and you're buying a property once every 7 years, there's potential value for that. So that's one point. The other point I also like to make around buyer's agents is, when you are buying lots of properties, and in our case, you know, we buy over 50 properties a month, there's a lot of clients behind that the selling agents also know to come to us for pre-market or off-market opportunities, and that don't necessarily get publicly made available. Now, I don't want to overstate that, because I think some buyer's agents overstate that's their competitive advantage. I'm just sort of saying that it is evident, and it's been more evident during COVID than probably normal. You might get, say, 10 to 15%, maybe even 20% off market in a normal environment. That has moved the dial, you know, and I'm being anecdotal here. We've only got one sample of our own business, but we're sort of 40 and in some cases 50% of some of the properties we're buying in certain marketplaces aren't actually getting time to go to market. So they're not necessarily off market, but they're pre-market, and you know, we're getting them done, because the challenge is when they are open up to the market, the risk is that, you know, someone will pay overs for that property, which means that we can't get it for our client. But that's an example of some of the benefits you might get by using a professional.
Good answer. And I'm going to move on. We sort of somewhat answered this, but I'm going to answer anyway. This comes from Thomas. People aren't allowed to their houses to inspect, and others are losing their jobs with COVID climate, yet demand seems higher than ever, with $800,000 houses selling for $200,000 over the top end of the estimated price range. Will the market plateau or dip soon? If not, what is causing this demand? We sort of did answer this.
Yeah, I think we have. I mean, we've basically said that this COVID experience has also led to people wanting security and potentially wanting a house over, you know, sort of the freedoms of using their backyard or whatever. So we are seeing a lot of upsizing and downsizing, owner-occupier appeal. We're now starting to see the investors coming back into the market, and that's without the migration story. So I still see the demand program over the next 2 or 3 years, if we can open up and let the new migrants come into the country, because they traditionally rent. So that's going to underpin rental demand. And if, you know, sort of medium and high density accommodation is not coming out of the ground quick enough, they're also going to have to find accommodation in which to live. So I think the fundamentals for property are really terrific. The question really is about what sort of speed humps are going to be introduced to reduce that level of demand, because I think it's going to be healthy for some time to come.
Yeah, and I would agree completely. Next question comes from Simon. With all this talk about broad inflation risk, what impact would a substantial increase in inflation, in brackets, and the probably rates as well, have on the housing market over the next few years? It would be safe haven, or is there a mortgage stress problem? I'm interested as a prospective buyer. Thanks, and great job as always. Thanks, Simon.
Yeah, so property is a good inflation hedge if you own it. When building materials and the cost to build a dwelling is skyrocketing, ultimately, you're benefiting from that inflation hedge. Now, again, it's not a reason why you invest in property, but it is certainly a benefit of that. Now, if Simon's question is around, that will obviously mean that if it gets out of hand, we're going to see interest rates go up, and that's going to potentially put risk in terms of households' mortgage stress. There's been a lot of talk around mortgage stress many, many times, including back when the macro prudential came in 2017, 2018. And we've heard, some fear mongering around property prices are going to crash by 40% because of mortgage stress. The concentration of that mortgage stress is really, really hard to identify, and it's sort of done in a rudimentary data sense. So I'm not so confident that mortgage stress is one of these things that you're going to see collapsing, the property market around that. So my view, I think this inflationary piece is transitionary. I think it doesn't get transitionary if the health issues continue on. I think it becomes more material than that. But if we are able to open up mobility and open up supply and get people back into the workforce to allow us to produce the goods that we need where the pressure's on, I think it will be transitionary. So I don't have that sort of same worry about inflation and higher interest rates. But I also aren't necessarily buying in that a 1% change in interest rates or a 1 to 2% change in interest rate is going to be a problem, because I also know that all the current lending at the moment is being assessed on serviceability rates of 5.5%, 6%. So I think with that in mind, it's not of concern to me at the moment.
Yeah, and my point of view from that being obviously looking at it from the economic side and listening to what the RBA is saying is that higher rates, when they do come, because it will come, when it does come, it's not going to be a level like even as early as 2010. We are not talking about rates in the sevens for a mortgage. We are talking about rates that may move from where they currently are, which is a 2 or a 3 handle, moving into probably at most 5. Because it's going to be quarter notch movements very, very slowly. And I mean very slowly. The RBA is clearly making the claim to what they're doing at the moment is that they would rather things over the next couple of years particularly run hot. They would rather do things incrementally and slowly rather than spooking things. So if we're at 0.1 of 1% in the cash rate now, my belief is that what they'll do is, in my eyes, normalize. So they'll add the 15 basis points back, get us back to a quarter notch, so 0.25 of 1%, and then slowly but surely see what happens. We also have inflation mandates in this country that are significantly higher than the rest of the world. Remember, we need between 2 and 3% on a core basis, so that's trim mean. And the RBA has basically said that until it gets to 2.5%, only then would we entertain it. We haven't been at 2.5% for over 7 years. We haven't been inside that band since the third quarter of 2015. So at the end of this month, it'll be 6 years since we had inflation at 2%, let alone getting to 2.5%. So there is a lot of reason why, and I'm one of them, I think the market is overpricing the idea that there's going to be this rate rise. It'll happen. And as I said, I see the 15 basis points, but I don't see all of a sudden 50 basis points or 75 basis points coming very quickly or even inside before 2025. I just don't see it happening at the moment because they're now making very clear that the other mandate in full employment needs to be part of it, and we're a long way away from that.
That's right. A lot of people forget that if interest rates are going up other than sort of a deflationary risk, the reality is the economy must be booming.
Yeah.
And as you say, that full employment would be there, and really they're just putting the levers on slowing the economy down. We haven't seen that in our economy for a long time, as you say, Evan.
Next question comes from Detlef, and I hope I've pronounced that right. What do you guys expect to occur to property prices when the borders open up completely to overseas arrivals? Great question.
Yeah, look, I mean, if we move back to that sort of 300,000 new arrivals per annum, and I think, you know, from economic point of view and the skill shortage point of view, I do believe that the current government of the day has an appetite for bringing that migration program into play, bringing the students back. That's a story, a demand side story again. So that bodes well for property, for yield. So it's actually a good news story. And we've also seen, you know, interest rate migration occurring as people are moving to sort of, away from the COVID issues that we've had. Again, I'm not sure whether that's long term. I've seen, you know, the story of most people leaving Melbourne in the late 80s, early 90s to move to Queensland only to see Melbourne become, you know, basically the most popular location pre-COVID to grow population. So I just think it's just a no-brainer that it's going to put some more pressure on the housing market.
I'd agree. Final question, and I think it's a good one to finish on. It's something you have touched on before, but I do want to say this is Lehman. Is it worth stretching financially to get into a bigger property, or is it best to play it safe?
Now, there's always a case by case and a caveat. Correct. Here, but I'm on record everywhere of basically saying this. If you can afford to buy property today and also for the next five years as an absolute minimum, in other words, if you're looking to start a family, you need to consider your cash flows around, you know, going down to a single income for a period of time. If those stress tests measure out and you've got yourself a buffer or a safety net, that could be the bank of mum and dad or whatever that looks like, and you're having those honest conversations, then I don't mind the idea of you buying the best asset you can to meet your needs and your lifestyle design. Because one of the things we're passionate about is not so much the wealth it creates, but it's basically how's it fitting into your personal goals and your lifestyle design. And so when people come to have those conversations, that's my first question is, how does it align with the lifestyle you want to live, and how stressful would that be when you're putting your head on the pillow each night, knowing where the next repayment's going to come from? If it's going to do that, then it's obviously a silly idea. But if it's going to align with the fact that you've got some backup or some buffers there, then, you know, by all means, do the best you can to get into the best location you can to live out your lifestyle dreams.
Ben Kingsley, thank you so much for joining us here at the Money Cafe. Thank you to everybody for listening in to the Money Cafe. Alan is back next week. He is finally back from it, from his knee replacement. And I'm sure he's going to tell you all about it because he loves to talk about that kind of stuff. So Alan is back next week. So make sure to send in your questions to him. As I said, halfway through the podcast, it's the Money Cafe at eurekaport.com.au. Thank you also to everybody out there who's listened to me over the last few of them. I know they've been a little bit different, but I hope you've liked them. And today particularly, I think Ben's been absolutely brilliant. So thank you again. Talk to you soon. Have a great week.